weekly live stream recording of the M&A Zing, a podcast series devoted to acquisition entrepreneurs, search funds and holdco builders in the UK and EU, discussing the topics and challenges that impact SMB succession M&A and exploring the highs and lows of searching, acquiring, owning and operating small and medium sized businesses. I am joined as ever by my co-host Gareth Hawkins, serial acquirer and CEO of BizCrunch. Let's start off with the news. What's the news this week?
Well, the main news, which will probably occupy all the time we have for it, is the big scandalous knee-jerk parochial policy that has come in last Friday in the US with the invoking of a policy change by the SBA that's in response to or in compliance with an executive order that came from Trump in his first few days in office that is... I think the executive order was called Protecting American Citizens from Invasion. So, quite hard hitting. But this invasion apparently also extends to foreign overseas beneficiaries of SBA loans. So they don't want to send money over the borders. But what that's basically meant at the SBA level is that henceforth, no company that has even 1% of foreign ownership will qualify for an SBA 7A or 504 loan. So that basically means that leveraged search fund investing by non-US investors is no longer able to avail itself of the SBA.
I didn't know that it was as little as 1%. I thought maybe, you know, majority ownership or something along those lines, but it's a blanket ban.
Yep, blanket ban. The eligibility requirement from this moment forward is 100% domestic ownership. So even 0.5% seems to no longer qualify, which is just like unbelievable. Because you'd have thought that, you know, table stakes for a globalized economy is to encourage foreign direct investments into your progressive market, right? So surely you want to alleviate some of the burden on the taxpayer of the country. Now, you know, searchers in the US can't really viably go to overseas, like European-based search fund investors and say, hey, come and back us, and then want to use that kind of equity gap piece, maybe the 50, 60% they might have raised of the deal in a traditional search fund sense. They might have raised some of that from overseas and then want to go and do a leveraged buyout with the SBA. That is no longer possible if they have any Europeans on their cap table. So, yeah.
Do you think that, and I, you know, this is obviously not great for those in the US. Do you think that it might mean that there's more money in EU search funds and for EU acquirers?
Well, I mean, I've already had several EU-based capital allocators that like this space reach out to me and say, what are we going to do about this? Like, what can be done? I'm now busily searching for deal flow in Europe and in the UK to allocate to instead, because they'll quite happily take my money and there's nothing to preclude me from receiving the returns or for those companies being able to avail themselves of government-backed funding. I think it will be a boon for European and UK, particularly potentially UK.
There's been obviously I don't want to touch on the US politics too much, but it does seem that a lot of those policies have kind of galvanized the EU and European Union and European business as well. So our gain is the US's loss. But yeah, I mean, who would expect short-sighted economic policies from a man that bankrupted four casinos?
Absolutely. Look, we are witnessing the Mancurian candidate. What can I say? If you want to dismantle a state by proxy, this seems to be how to do it. So there we are.
Seems so.
It will be an interesting 5 years ahead. We'll probably cause more business owners to explore an exit. So there we are. There we are, buyers. Might be in busy season. So it's interesting. I think it will be a boon for the UK search scene, which is burgeoning, already benefits from having lower multiples of EBITDA versus the US, which is a bit more toppy. It's got more competition, therefore it drives up valuations. Here there's much, much, much less competition, and therefore It's sort of, you know, a buyer's market in that sense. So anyway, that's the news, the big news this week. I've obviously used up all of our time quota, and we should move on to more, well, I would say positive things, but our topic this week,
the top 10 S&B M&A deal killers. Yeah, we're keeping it very cheerful this week. as we all know, you know, this is a game of deal flow. Lots of deals that are brought to the table don't go through. You know, I'm starting to witness it more and more, talking to, you know, BizCrunch users that are getting through the first calls we talked about last week, and then, you know, stumbling blocks seem to appear. So let's talk about what some of those are, and hopefully anybody listening can be, you know, pre-armed and pre-prepared before they go into their deals, and hopefully sidestep some of these potential pitfalls.
It is a minefield. I tell every searcher that I speak to that's, you know, down the road with a business that's under heads of terms, I'm quite of the mantra that it's off until it's on. You know, there's lots that could go wrong. You know, having spent a couple of years in the sort of venture space as well with the pre-seed market, and knowing that there's sort of like, you know, 80-90% death rates at pre-seed, like the law of averages tells you that, you know, this may not come to fruition the way that you'd hoped. So keep an open mind. So yeah, I think there's lots of things that are, you know, likely to cause a rethink on either side or both sides, cause a deal to fall apart, not get over the finish line. That has been proven out. We know that, you know, there's a very high deal failure rate. You know, part of our mandate at BizCrunch is to try and ultimately help solve that over time. But I think we'll easily get to the top 10, I think, and there's probably more behind that. But what are you seeing from your conversations you mentioned there recently? What's the big one at the top of your list?
Okay. I mean, top of the list, the one that comes up most often is valuation disagreements. Disagreements come out top. That is the one that I hear most regularly. And look, they come about a number of different ways. Sometimes a seller will have a number in their head, which is slightly optimistic, and they'll come to that conclusion on their own. Sometimes it can be that they've had an inflated valuation from a broker. That's one I've heard a couple of times.
No, perish the thought, sure.
But yes, this is one that comes up time and time again. And, you know, look, these aren't small amounts of money, you know, being brought to the table. And for the seller, you know, it represents however many years of hard work. You know, if we're talking about the silver tsunami, you know, baby boomer business sellers, you know, they may have had this business for 40, 50 years, and it's been their kind of lifeblood, and they expect a certain price for it. And maybe they come to market and it isn't quite worth what they thought. And their dreams of, you know, retiring to the south of France was slightly dented by a lower valuation than they expected. But yeah, this seems to be a really big stumbling block. It's the one that I hear more than any other.
You're absolutely right. I think some sellers potentially confuse earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization with expectations before I throw the book at it. isn't quite EBITDA, but you know what I mean? It's like the blood, sweat, and years that I've put in to this exercise. I value it on my multiples of effort, not multiples of profit. And yeah, that can be a problem. Sometimes if you've run companies as lifestyle businesses, you know, you've had all the money out of it. You have tried to keep you put some things through the P&L that, you know, that minimize your profitability and minimize your tax liability. Then, you know, when it comes time to sell it, you're maybe not going to get the valuation for it that you would like. And as you mentioned, I mean, Charlie Norton touched on this, who is a broker. He's seen some less scrupulous brokers, you know, try and win customer listings and listing agreement signatures, which is their ultimate goal, purely on the basis of saying, look, your business is worth 6, 7, 8 times EBITDA, when actually it's really, frankly, not in the market that we know. So, valuation disagreements, buyer coming from one angle with normally gravitated and grounded in reality and their expectation for future arbitrage. Seller valuing it more viscerally, more emotionally than financially. Can be a recipe for disaster, and normally means the deal doesn't get off the ground, does it?
No, and I think that part of the problem is, like you said, there's an emotional attachment. I think the buyers tend to go into this, you know, with less emotion. Although actually, I've seen that too often not be the case after, you know, many months of searching. But yeah, absolutely on the part of the sellers. I mean, that's the big difference between this and any other big purchase. You know, to them. buy a property or something like that, you know kind of what the market is. There's an expectation. You've spoken to other people that have sold their houses. You know what your neighbor sold his house for. Whereas lots of sellers get to this point in their journey and they maybe don't know anybody else that's been through this process, and they haven't had any direction on, you know, how to value, or even to, you know, as you said, if they have been putting things through on their P&L and they've been doing it for, you know, tax purposes, and it more makes sense, they haven't had anyone to say to them, hey, maybe don't do that for a couple of years before you sell.
Better preparation without manipulation, like a better awareness of how the market works, you know, how businesses are valued, what the process is going to look like. More preparedness to navigate the M&A process for a seller.
Maybe sellers that could be more connected in that process, and they could, you know, understand what the processes are, so that when buyer comes along and says, hey, you know, I've looked at your figures and actually you're worth X, maybe they can understand that a little bit better. Whereas otherwise they're kind of a bit, you know, in the dark up until that point of time.
Yeah, working backwards from the magic number can be a bit of a recipe for disaster. Actually working upwards from, you know, into reality based on earnings and adjusted earnings is the way. But yeah, so valuation disagreements, completely agree, should be number one on the list.
Yeah. Okay, so what's your next one on the list, Gareth?
Well, I think this speaks to a kind of an increase in the sort of Americanization of small business M&A and the over complexity of deal structures, right? So, you know, trying to raise finance in the UK, it's costly. So there is a propensity for buyers to want to reduce the amount of leverage to an affordable amount. Obviously, the lenders have their debt service cover ratio benchmarks. They want to make sure that the acquirers are sticking to. So, you know, you look to optimize your leverage. And as a consequence, you know, deferred consideration is playing an increased role. You know, I hear more and more about these like annuity deals where it's the business is paying out through profits ad infinitum to get the seller to the number they wanted to get to. But, you know, a lot of that now comes with conditionality attached. So like setting the expectations for continued growth or continued profitability above a certain threshold. So like those elements, it's, you know, it's not, and sellers should be under no illusion, there's very little 100% cash upfront deals going on these days. What deals there are often with a bit of contingency and are often heavily leveraged and are often not as much upfront as you used to get. So I think the complexity of some of those, the alchemy of some of those structures can lose the seller, can disillusion the seller, can actually be difficult for them to comprehend, and sometimes creates or presents too much risk for the seller. Like, hang on, you want to own, Mr. Buyer, you want to own 100% of my company going forward. But your ability to pay me out the balance of what you owe me is very much dependent on my ability to continue to grow the business. Although I don't have any ownership of it anymore, I have to kowtow to your way of working, and you could, you know, move the goalposts on me and I might not get my money. So there is an element of that which breeds suspicion, which breeds deal failure.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's entirely understandable. I mean, I can see both sides of the argument on this. Obviously, you know, finance is harder to find and expensive in the UK. And I can totally understand as a buyer wanting to find smart ways of still managing to get that acquisition over the line without having to, you know, over leverage or, you know, put too much money up front. But yeah, I mean, look, when you put it like that from the point of the seller, it doesn't sound too attractive at all, does it?
No, you've got to have a motivated seller that also has a good sense of belief in their company and their and a trust in the buyer. I think those three things need to align on the Venn diagram in order for you know, a highly contingent deal to get over the line. And they're happening, you know, they're happening. But there is a lot of the deals that don't complete. Often it's because the seller loses faith in the structure of the deal. So I think that's a worthy number two on the list, which probably brings us actually quite comfortably to another finance related or funding related reason, I guess, for reason number three.
Yes, which is lack of adequate finance, lack of adequate funding. This is one that I have also heard happening fairly regularly. And it's not so much buyers coming to the table without agreements in place and without having figured this stuff out. It's more changes along the way, you know, tighter lending standards triggered by economic uncertainty. I think about, you know, the situation we've seen in the UK over the last couple of years with rising interest rates. You may have got all of your ducks in a row, but by the time the acquisition process is over, you know, a couple of extra points on the interest of your loan, you know, could be massively detrimental to the plan that you've got. Especially, like you said, if you've got these kind of complex deal structures where it's a very fine balance of paying out, paying the lenders back and paying out the previous owner and those kind of things. So, I mean, this is kind of falls into that, you know, the Walker Dybul time kills deals thing. You know, if you've got your ducks in a row, maybe the longer it takes, the more chance you've got of something like this happen and the kind of rug being pulled from under you, I guess.
Yeah, you definitely want to make sure you've got your finance lined up, you know, with affordable cost of capital and, you know exactly what you're doing before you go in. But the ground can shift underneath you, as you quite rightly suggest. And as you get deeper into due diligence and the risk quantum of the company, of the target company starts to emerge and take shape, actually the interest rate that you thought you were going to get on the debt to leverage the acquisition increases and becomes less serviceable. And then you have to start shopping around looking for alternative creative ways of financing the leverage part of the deal. And that can cause you to go back to the drawing board, add time, add cost, and make it maybe not viable. You know, a business that might have purported to be doing 1.5 million of EBITDA, when you really get under the, you know, under the hood and do the deep dive quality of earnings type analysis, you might find it's only doing half of that. And that isn't sufficient to justify the debt service cover ratio they need, but also maybe creates a higher risk, reduce, maybe you look under the hood and maybe the credit rating might be impaired or likely to be impaired. And at that point, then you're not going to get, you know, prime interest rates. You're going to get slightly more risk managed interest rates, which might not be affordable for you as the buyer. So it's a moving feast sometimes.
I think in those cases where, you know, it isn't necessarily something that you found within the company that you're looking to acquire, but, you know, maybe market forces change or, you know, interest rates, whatever that might be. We go back to that previous point of the seller needing trust in the buyer, not getting cold feet. And I think if you are, you know, approaching, you know, completion for this, and then suddenly you find out that your buyer is having to scramble around to find finances from elsewhere, that's going to be a scary moment for any seller. You know, you've got one foot out of the door in your mind. You're ready to sell. You're ready to move on. You've overcome all these trust hurdles, and now suddenly they don't have the money that they said they did.
And you've emotionally committed to the transaction. You've got the sunk cost fallacy of all the time and effort you put into it, that, you know, you really want to see it through to the end, and you should. And you should be able to get, you know, what's rightly yours. If nothing internally to the company has shifted, and, you know, there hasn't been a massive change in the quality of the company's earnings, if the scenario around you has shifted and it stymies your buyer, then it can be a problem.
Once again, our point has kind of segued us nicely onto the next.
It's almost like we intended that. I wish I could say we did. But logically, number four should therefore be having to revalue the company based on a quality of earnings report, right? At least restructure the deal, but more likely probably revalue the company. Add backs are interesting. Adjusted EBITDA is a science in and of itself, or maybe more of an art of itself. And when you peel that away and really get to the nitty gritty of how cash generative a company is and how legitimate some of those line items are, a quality of earnings report, which I would recommend to anybody, you know, making a serious acquisition, I recommend getting under the hood, having a proper accountant look at the Xero or the QuickBooks or the Sage or whatever, and really get into the numbers. When you do that, oftentimes the EBITDA that was presented is nowhere near the truth, and so you have to have that difficult conversation with the seller. And at that point, maybe the number just falls below the material kind of threshold that they want, and they walk away.
So, I mean, how common is this? Someone that's, you know, been through this process a number of times, is this a problem that you've come up against?
Oh, there's a reason why it's number four, because it happens a lot, right? Happens a lot. You're in this push and pull between navigating previous tax mitigated accounts, and then, you know, having the alchemy of advisors having, you know, created an EBITDA that's got some add backs in it and various different, you know, extraordinary costs sucked out and all that sort of stuff. So, and then you've got to prove it, and then you've got to get into the sort of detail of, you know, whether there is customer concentration, whether the debtor days are, you know, the account receivable days are as efficient and viable as you maybe thought they were, whether really the gross margins that were purported in the SIM in the information memorandum are actually real and viable when you get under the hood, whether they're properly accounting for things in the cost of sales or even in the overheads. So, you know, you really start to study margins and go, yeah, I think you might be lying to yourself here, Mr. Seller, for convenient reasons. Then you have to have that frank conversation, and probably that's the go, no go moment for the seller. Well, I'm not going to get what I thought I was, but do I still want to sell it?
I think that this is yet another situation in which some portion of sort of exit readiness on behalf of the seller would be a wise thing to do. You know, I think if more sellers had a certain amount of prep work that they knew to go through, and I'm not talking about a couple of months before for sale, I'm talking, you know, in the years leading up to it, and there was some kind of curriculum that they could follow. And I know that there are lots of people that offer these kind of things, but, you know, I think these are all things that could be sorted well in advance, especially if it is something that's so common.
But a curriculum in tandem with some proper kind of shoulder-to-shoulder advice, like good M&A advisors get into the trenches with the company, with the seller, right? So if it's sell-side advisory, they'll get into the trenches, they'll pull out all the ledgers, they'll you know, really look and scrutinize the P&L specifically, and they'll you know, come up with something, and they'll explain it to the seller. They'll you know, they'll say this won't stand scrutiny, and this is what we can say, and this is what we really shouldn't, and when the due diligence comes, this is what's going to get, you know, chipped away at. So I mean, I think if there is no substitute for having good people in your camp that understand how to navigate this and know what you can and can't do, but yes, there are lots of deals that come to market where that work hasn't been done, an internal audit like that hasn't been done. And yeah, that's where the surprises come from.
The skeletons in the closet, as it were.
Indeed. There is nowhere to hide, really, in due diligence. There shouldn't be anywhere to hide.
No, hopefully not. Okay, well, this leads us on to our next point, which is retrading by the buyer. We've touched on this already. It doesn't necessarily...
Well, we've touched on it when in relation to justification, like when it's having to be retraded because the numbers aren't what they purported to be. But you do get a lot of retrading where it's just for shizzles, right? For sport. You know, let me see if I can cheese pair this a little bit down because the seller has emotionally attached.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's probably where these deals are most likely to fall apart. I think a reasonable seller, for all the emotional attachment and all of the kind of, you know, blood, sweat and tears that they've put into a business, I think if you do, you know, unearth a skeleton in a closet and you say, hey, I'm going to have to retrade, I'm going to have to bring the price down here, they would understand. But I do think that quite obviously, if you are a ways down the line and then suddenly, because you think they're so invested, you can agree yourself a better price. That's not exactly great business practice. I mean, if it comes off for you, I suppose it could be prudent acquiring, but there's no wonder why this is going to be a big deal collapser for any seller.
It could be so acrimonious as well. Like it feels personal. It feels like you have been taken advantage of, right? Like it feels like the sophisticated capital allocator has taken advantage of the naivete of an ambitious seller or an emotionally attached seller. And so you will find sellers taking that really personally.
Yeah, and I think, I was just going to say understandably so. I mean, from the buyer's point of view, it's rarely, I think, a personal thing. It's just business, but I can totally see why you would take it personally.
Well, buyers are going to squeeze it till the pipsqueak, right? They're going to see exactly how little capital they have to come up with, how much they can make contingent, how testable, how elastic the valuation is, how elastic the appetite of the seller is. They're going to test some things, but, you know, I think after a certain time, there's sort of, you know, there's good conduct. Do you want to kill it at the 11th hour because you want to take 20% or 10% off the asking price?
Yeah, I think there's also probably a certain amount of, rather than it's just for shizzles, as you so eloquently put it, I think there may also be at times at which, you know, problems do arise during due diligence, and buyers may kind of overstate the damage that that would do to the price. And, you know, small thing pops up, you know, maybe the quality of earnings report reveals a couple of things aren't quite as expected. And buyer says, well, look, now's a chance for me to, like you said, squeeze until the pip squeak. You're full of great quotes this week, I have to say.
I do my best. So yeah, I think retrading happens, sometimes justified, sometimes not. Where it's not, there's a right place, right time. And the closer you get to SPA, you know, the more you're really testing it and making a decision whether you want to throw away all that hard work and cost that you've put then that far. Because the seller could take it personally and say, well, screw you, Jack.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Gareth, what's yours? What's number
six?
Well,
so we see some deals failing due to regulatory and legal hurdles. So where like regulated businesses have issues around changes of ownership, the license that they're afforded or the permissions that they are granted by a regulatory body actually requires the acquirer to have the same qualifications, credentials and accreditations as the seller had. And then maybe that hasn't been researched properly, or they thought they could retain them by retaining the seller. And then the seller says, well, actually, you know, I don't want to still carry that liability if I don't get the upside. So, you know, you're going to have to go and become a FCA registered manager or something if you want to buy this fintech. There are some scenarios like that. You know, I'm working with somebody at the moment who is looking at doing a roll up of regional law firms.
Okay.
And he's not a lawyer. And so he's had to think through very carefully about how using the alternative business structure ABS approach, he can become a regulated, you know, become known to the SRA that sort of are the regulator of that field in order for him to be able to pull the trigger on his acquisition. So, I mean, that won't kill the deal by any means, but it adds time and adds complexity to the deal.
And costs.
Feasibly. So, regulatory and legal hurdles you have to think them through well ahead. You have to know what you're getting into. If they come up as a surprise, sometimes they're not costed. Sometimes they can add some real time to the deal. And as we'll come on to with item seven, reason seven.
You know, protracted legal processes. So this is the correct point for my Walker Diabel quote, which is time kills deals, but it's the deal fatigue thing, right? So, this tends to happen, from what I understand, at the stage at which, you know, lawyers start to get involved with documents, and they call it the bloodbath of red ink gets traded from one side to the other. And, you know, disputes over intellectual property rights or contract clauses or whatever it might be will just drag on and on and on. And we're kind of playing this sort of contract tennis from one side to the other until the point at which you know, relationships are strained and one side caves.
It's you have to look at it from the lawyer's perspective, that they're trying to do the best for their clients. But there is a materiality threshold where you're really getting down to just arguing small points, and it's costing you more in legal fees as the buyer or seller to negotiate those points than it is going to save you or make you once those points are agreed. So I think you have to call it, you know, at some point and say, come on, let's be reasonable, let's get this deal done. I think if there is a desire, a momentum amongst both parties, then the lawyers will, you know, work at the speed that you need them to. And you can set the rules around, look, this is the bits that I care about. These are the battles I want to win. If you give a lawyer an open-ended checkbook, they will write as many checks as they can from it. And I'm not saying that's a criminal thing. I'm just saying that they will continue to provide billable hours, right, in your best interest. So they think.
Look, a lawyer's job is to protect you at all costs and to protect you from any potential pitfalls that might pop up. But this isn't the kind of process where that can be done. You know, there is going to be some risk to both parties in a process like this, and I think lawyers can get cold feet at that, because that's not what they're trained to do. They're trained to protect their client from all risk. But like you said, I think it's about briefing your lawyer on that and saying, you know, this is what is acceptable to me. This
could also be about agreeing. Could also be about agreeing a fixed fee. Like if you are agreeing a fixed fee with your law firm, and there are some out there that will act for a fixed fee on a sort of a low complexity, modest valuation deal. They'll, you know, it's not in their interest to keep throwing billable hours at it, because they start to subsidize the deal. So
Do you think it's prudent to instruct a firm that have experience in this particular field then?
Oh, goodness, yes, absolutely. Don't go off to a probate lawyer and ask him to do an M&A SPA for you. That could be fraught with risk. So no, use the experts, but try and use experts that are realistic, that will work at your pace, that will understand how deep you do or don't want to go. And if possible, they'll set you a fixed fee.
Awesome. Good Great. Advice there. Okay, Gareth, yep. What's yours? What's your number eight?
Well, coming in at number eight is shifts in market and economic conditions. So we've seen quite a lot of market and economic volatility over the last few years. Mm-hmm. The amount of deals that going into COVID, for example, went on hiatus for a period because, you know, the bottom fell out of the world for a few months. There was significant seismic headwinds that come at you can put deals on pause. And, you know, I've seen this in corp dev as well, where corporations are down the road with a transaction and then they have a big impairment of their share price, for example, if they're a publicly traded corporation. Mm. And then they have to just sort of say, look, we're going to put this on ice. We'll come back to it in X amount of time. Sometimes you think you're merrily going along, you know, in a direction that's going to complete lights at the end of the tunnel. We're going to get this done in 8 weeks. And then, crickets, because they've had to down tools.
Well, I mean, look at the news that we started this podcast with. I mean, how many deals do you think that's affected?
I know a lot of deals seem to have gone back to review with SBA lenders in order to make sure that they can qualify. And there's now a burden of proof on the applicant to fill out some stuff on a digital platform to kind of attest to the fact that they're 100% US owned. So that will add time and cost and potentially lose a few along the way. Mm. So anyway, we don't need to dwell too much on that point, but shifts happen.
nice.
Thanks. Inadequate advisory and legal support. Tell us all about that, Alfie, number nine.
Yes. So on the flip side to point seven, I think that some people go into this process kind of underarmed with advisors and not prepared to have the legal support that they need. And I think that, look, you are always going to need to consult an expert on any process like this. I think that this is something that's potentially going to happen more and more as we start to see more acquirers come to the market from non-traditional sources, shall we say. Mm-hmm. So yeah. People that have been through, you know, courses and masterminds and groups and self-taught is happening a lot more. And I think that I very much applaud that DIY approach. And I do think there is a lot of the work that you can take on yourself. But I think once you get into, you know, contract negotiations and the actual acquisition process, I think if you go in without the right counsel, I think that number one, you can find yourself in deep water pretty quickly. And I think that, you know, when disputes arise, it's going to take so much longer for you to reply. You may have to then go back to the drawing board and try and find those advisors whilst in the midst of a deal, which is going to slow things down. I also think, again, if we go back to, you know, seller trust, I think that at the point at which they realize that perhaps you aren't quite as well armed with a team of good advisors as you should be, that could actually put them off at that point in time too.
Yeah, I do. Seen that happen. Yeah. Does this guy really know what he's doing? I think I've heard on more than one occasion. first time acquirers should definitely, you know, if you want to go far, go together, isn't it? Wasn't that what we say? Like, you want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go together. I think, you know, first-time acquirers, it's a beautiful space, this acquisition entrepreneurship space. There is a fantastic community attached to it internationally. Yeah. And the sense of collaboration is just inspiring, right? So there's always somebody that's got your back, that has had this experience, that has faced this challenge and can help you overcome it. So I do think if you're going to do this for your first time, do it with somebody. Get advice, get a coach, get a mentor, get good help. From a seller's perspective, that's less well served. Like, you know, there's not enough exiteers out there that go and help other sellers to achieve the same end. And maybe there's something that needs to be solved there. And I know Rach at The Grafter is doing a great job there with her team of exiteers. Who are, you know, coaches for that exact, you know, Sherpas for that exact mission. And that's fab, you know, follow me, I've done this. That's indispensable. So, I think it's not as well served in the M&A space for the sell side. There are good M&A advisors that you know will do that with you, and obviously you should look for them and engage them as you see fit. But the buyers are a little bit spoilt because communities and professional services are abound for, on the buy side.
Why do we think that there is a kind of dearth of seller advisors and seller Sherpas, which I think is a fantastic term? Like, you know, Rachel the Grafter is doing a great job. But yeah, I can't think of too many more that are out there. Why do you think that is?
I think probably the volume of transactions until now hasn't really been sufficiently substantial, right? We're talking about less than 2,000 a year, SMB, M&A, succession transactions. That's like, you know, is that sufficient for an ecosystem to pop up around it? I think also the fragmentation and the disparate, like widespread, you know, distribution of sellers, like there aren't, unless you're in a trade body or an industry association or whatever, you probably aren't speaking to people that have necessarily been down this road. So like finding somebody who is like you, who is going through the same challenge is tough. Whereas, you know, all buyers potentially start from the same position, not all sellers do. And then finding a common, you know, ally is tough.
Mm. Yeah. And you know, this has been a point that's kind of persisted throughout this is that as much as, you know, buyers need to go into this with preparation and with mentors and with the right team around them. I do think, especially from the buyers that I've spoken to, that they are very motivated to do this and they are going out there and educating themselves and they are part of groups and they are finding support and they are learning. And actually, you know, for most of the points that we've covered here, I think some, you know, steps towards better seller preparation is could really solve so many of these problems.
100% agree with you. But is it fail to plan, plan to fail, or fail to
prepare? Fail to prepare, prepare to fail.
There you go. Right. So yeah. I think that axiom definitely applies here. Yeah. So we're down to the last one, Alfie, number 10, mate. This is it. We've managed to get all the way through our list, and I do think there are many more behind this. But we should probably mention that somewhere along your journey as a seller. And as a buyer, you're going to actually work out in a deal whether you feel you could work with this person, whether you feel that the workforce and the values of the companies are going to gel, particularly if you're looking to do this as a tuck-in or a bolt-on, or you're acquiring another company into a group. You want to make sure it's harmonious, right? And that there are these cultural and management alignments rather than mismatches. And so we've put top at number 10 reason as being a mismatch in culture and management. So yeah, I think that's something that only becomes apparent the further down the due diligence you get and the more of the stakeholders that you meet and the more you hear kind of viscerally from each side. Are these people that we feel we could work with longer term, like post-deal? And sometimes people walk away because they're like, I don't see our businesses fitting together, regardless of all the financial and the deal structuring. Blah, 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 I just don't think this is a good home for my business, or I don't think they'll make a good addition to my business.
Well, and also, you know, going back to the point you made earlier about more modern types of deal structuring and, you know, annuities or goals and such, there is an expectation for seller and buyer to work together beyond completion date and much more, and that's something that needs to be considered. You know, like you said, if these people don't gel, do you feel like you can work with them, especially if you are the person who built this business? Can you kowtow to their demands and work in their way after the ink is dried on the paper?
Yeah, and that's the thing, you have to be able to envisage that your workforce will be happy in that new, under those new conditions, when you are no longer calling the shots for the company. And that's very difficult to tell going in. It becomes slightly more apparent the more you interact with the other party, the further along the sort of process you get and the more trust you either build or don't build. So, but I mean, we actually tackle this in our ebook. So maybe you might want to mention that, because I know you and your team have been hard at work there.
Yes. So publishing very soon is our book, myself and Gareth, Cultural Cohesion, Strategies for Integration Post-Acquisition. And we cover a range of topics in here. So best practices for integrating teams, communication strategies, leadership alignment, employee retention, change management. There is absolutely everything in here that you should need to know to manage that process. And also, you know, talking about this, you know, the cultural cohesion with the buyer and seller. We did touch on this last week in last week's episode. So if you didn't listen to that, go back and listen to it, because you know, working out whether you are the right people to work together begins in that very first call.
Yeah, true. It does. As I say, it's the dance of the seven veils. So you don't necessarily get the true inside picture at that point. But it is, you know, if your heckles are up and you think, my goodness, we're never going to gel these two cultures together, then, yeah, maybe it's a ripcord moment.
Yeah. And yes, the ebook will be available on all major platforms, and it will be provided free of charge to all community members. So those of you listening in the community, you'll get that delivered directly to you. And everybody else, keep your eyes out for the socials. Publishing date should be early April.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, we managed it. We got to 10 and we did it. We've only slightly invading the AMA time. So a slightly longer episode this week, folks. But I hope you found it super useful. Next week, we've got a guest. We're starting off in a series of interviewing emerging and experienced searchers, self-funded or traditional. And so, yeah, very delighted. We won't disclose the name yet, but we'll see it in the build-up, that we have an emerging searcher in the UK scene who's coming to tell us about their journey and their ambitions and their progress. So, yeah, tune in next week for that one. Meanwhile, have a great week and keep on crunching.
Keep on crunching, guys.